And our special guest tonight, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And in a moment, he'll be joined by a mutual friend of both of ours on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with, of course, Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And Edgar, I remember in St. Louis when you were telling me an incredible story of your work about a tie clasp that you had lost when you were meeting your dear friend Uri Geller. So we're going live to England right now, and we're going to bring Uri in for the next half hour with you. Uri, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you very much. It's such a pleasure to be on with my great friend, Ed Mitchell. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Hello, Uri. How are you?
There you go. When's the last time you two either chatted with each other or saw each other? Uri?
Well, I am in touch with Ed, I would say, all the time. I just saw his picture in USA Today just a few days ago. And I was on an airplane, and I pulled out my BlackBerry and emailed him, "Hey, Ed, I just saw your picture." And it took Ed about a day and a half to email me back, but it did.
And Uri, let me also just say happy Rosh Hashanah to you, my friend. And Edgar, let's let you relate first the story, this incredible story of the tie clasps, and then we'll get Uri to mention his role in this. It's an incredible story.
Okay. Well, certainly, very briefly, it was when we were doing work at Stanford Research Institute, now called SRI International, and testing, trying to show what Uri was able to do with his newfound to us capabilities that we hadn't seen before. And we were doing all sorts of things in psychokinesis and teleportation and such research. And I'll have to admit, there were times when I would say, "Uri, come on, let's focus on the experiment now." And anyhow, the story came up about my camera on the moon. And my story of this, Uri can chime in here. My story was, I said, "Uri, if you're going to teleportation, there's a camera I left on the moon that has a serial number on it. NASA knows about it. Bring that back, and you'll really be a famous guy." Well, of course, what I didn't tell him, it was anchored to that little cart that we used to pull it around. So it weighed a couple hundred pounds. It's a little difficult to get back. Anyhow, the offshot of that was the next day we were in the cafeteria at SRI and having lunch, and all of us sitting around the table. And I kind of have a feeling that Uri's mind was going on Ed Mitchell's lost camera, how can I get that back, and et cetera, et cetera. But what happened instead was, as we finished our lunch, Uri asked for some iced cream. And I had the waitress, we're sitting right next together, had the waitress bring a dish of ice cream. Uri took a couple of bites out of this goblet that had the ice cream in it, and cried out in pain. Blood came to his lips, and he took a chunk of ice cream out of his mouth, and I washed it off in the spoon in my glass, and discovered it was an emblem that looked like a hunting arrow, a three-fluted hunting arrow with a ram's head on it. And I held this up to the crowd and said, "Gentlemen, look at this." And they said, "What is it?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, but it looks like the emblem on a tie pin that I had that was in a jewel box that I lost a couple of years ago before Uri and I ever met." And so the scientist and the mathematician started computing the probability that something looking like Ed Mitchell's tie pins would show up in Uri Geller's ice cream while we were doing experiments in psychokinesis. Ha, ha, ha. So I put it in my pocket, and we went back to the lab to start the afternoon's work. And I went into the inner lab to set up the afternoon, and Uri helped put off a number of the other people, including Shippey, and five or six people were standing in the outer room. And all of a sudden, I heard a plink, something hitting a tile floor outside, and looked out just in time to see Dr. Puthoff pick up something off the floor. And then I said, "What is that?" And he said, "Well, here it is." He handed it to me. And I said, "Well, that's the tie bar that this ram's head emblem goes on." And so, ha-ha, what's the probability of two things?
Exactly.
Showing up and all of this. So back to work again. Puthoff and I went on to the inner lab and started to work with Uri and the rest still standing outside. With just the two of us in the room, suddenly a third object just seemed to drop to the floor. I reached down and picked it up, and it just seemed to come out of nowhere. I reached down and picked it up, and Puthoff said to me, "What is that?" And I said, "Well, it is a pearl stick pin with a silver shank and a brass clutch back on it." They said, "What's that mean?" I said, "Well, I had a silver, a pearl stick pin with a silver shank and a silver clutch back that my brother had brought, sent me from Japan when he was in duty over there a few years ago. And I had lost the silver clutch back on it and put a brass clutch back from my Navy wings on it. And it was in the same jewel box that I lost with these other two objects." So here we had three objects that Uri and his rambling mind had suddenly picked up in cyberspace somewhere and presented them to us without anybody touching it. It just appeared in these things. So it's quite a crazy story. It's not good science, but it sure is awfully good anecdotal.
It's a great radio story. Yeah.
Right, and I still have those in my safe here 30-something years later.
Uri, what's your take on this story? What happened?
Well, you know, I wish I knew the technicality of what happens when a teleportation occurs. I simply can't explain it. I know that it happened. It blew my mind because you don't find metallic objects in your ice cream, do you?
Not normally.
And what an odd object it was. I had no idea that this belonged to Ed. The first thought that came to my mind was that, you know, someone at the factory or wherever they manufactured the ice cream, something fell into the ice cream. But when Ed said, "Hey, this is mine," you know, I just realized that, yes, there was a teleportation. It came from somewhere. You know, the object that Ed lost, he lost it, like he said, 2 or 3 years before he ever met me. And I realized that there was something out there telling me that, "Hey, Uri, forget bringing the camera back. This is what's going to happen." And when the whole typing came together, it led me to believe that there is either a thinking entity behind this phenomena, or your mind can assemble certain things from the past, and in such an order that is just so extraordinary, it is so astonishing. I had similar occurrences happen to me in the past, but it certainly doesn't happen every day. And I tell this story, you know, to people, and they look at me and they say, "Yeah, sure, come on, this never happened. This is a great story, but it's made up, isn't it?" And no, it's not made up. It really, really happened, and you'll have to believe us. Definitely, you'll have to believe Ed. But isn't it mind-blowing? I mean, I'm sure that all your listeners now, at least whoever is not skeptical, says, you know, this is, wow, how can these things happen? But they do.
You know, Uri, I was in a conference just a few weeks ago in San Jose, and a woman came up to me and said, "If you ever talk to Uri Geller again, thank him for starting my watch that hadn't started in 22 years.
Well, you know, it's funny that you should say this, but last night I came back from Germany. I was in Hanover and Hamburg and Berlin, and I was interviewed on a TV show, and I didn't want to do anything, but the host, the presenter, brought up an old show that I have done 35 years ago called Wim Tölke, where, of course, I would do my kind of famous feat of looking into the camera and asking people to get their broken watches, and I would say 1, 2, 3 work. And for many, many years, I always thought that it was my energy. But of course, I was wrong. I'm only a catalyst when this happens. I'm an enabler, and I kind of influence the belief system of the people who are holding the broken watches. But to cut the long story short, you know, people tell me, well, Uri, you know, the cynics, they say, well, if you shake the watch or you warm the oil, it'll start working. Well, okay, I accept that. But what about the hundreds of emails and faxes I used to get, letters from people who tell me, Uri, I had a 100-year-old pocket watch. And of course, it was broken. And I took it several times to a watchmaker. And the watchmaker would look at it, open it up, and say, hey, forget it. I will never be able to fix it because there's actually either a part missing or a broken part inside the pocket watch. And this factory doesn't even exist anymore. I can't fix it. I can't get the part to make the pocket watch start ticking. And it does. The watch starts ticking. And people are astonished and amazed. So am I. Because to this day, after 55 years doing this, demonstrating this ability, I have absolutely no scientific or rational explanation how the watch starts and comes alive. And the only explanation I have, that there must be some type of a materialization or teleportation of the broken part that comes into the watch, fixes the watch, and it comes alive.
Or you have some ability, Uri, to just amass incredible energy around this watch, and that somehow is able to overtake everything.
Well,
this is Edgar. The one thing that we really have not been able to model within science very well is precisely this psychokinetic phenomenon of organizing matter in this way. The rest of the so-called paranormal stuff, and I don't even use that word anymore, paranormal, it's all normal stuff, is largely explainable by within the quantum mechanical framework. But this one still remains elusive. I'll have to admit that.
Uri, what's going on with the Chris Angel show with you and trying to find the future mentalists?
Yes, this is a great series on NBC starting on the 17th of October. You know, again, I get a lot of emails from people who ask me, hey, Uri, you know, how come you're lining yourself up with Chris Angel, who is a magician? Well, my answer to that is very simple. The series is really about finding a great performer. When I did the series in Israel just under a year ago, we didn't realize that it was going to be such a great hit. It got 50% of the market share. It broke all historical rating records. And when it was snapped up, the format was snapped up by many, many different countries around the world, I made it clear. And the first thing that I say on the stage when I walk out, the host, the presenter, usually asks me, hey, Uri, what is this? Is this, these guys have paranormal powers? What are they? Are they illusionists? Are they mentalists? Are they psychological manipulators? And my answer is immediate. I say, I don't care what they are and how they do it. What I do care about is the most mesmerizing, amazing, mind-blowing performance. So this is what the show is about. We're looking for the great, the next great mentalist in the United States. So I'm very, very thrilled because let's face it, I've been around, as I said before, for a long time. And for something like this to happen at this stage in my life is just wonderful. So it's NBC, October the 17th. Don't miss the show because it's going to be mind-blowing.
Well, it's going to be exciting. We've got to get you back on Coast to Coast right before that program again, Uri, okay?
Thank you. And let me just say that Chris Angel is just such a great guy, and he's skills and talents are amazing. You know, I've seen some of his videos on YouTube, and you know, I just don't know how he does it.
I'm not sure he's human, right? I'm not sure he's human. There's something else there, you know?
Well, I just spent some time in the desert with him outside Los Angeles just a week ago because we were shooting the promo for NBC. And the same thought went through my mind, too.
Edgar, I'm sure you've seen some of Chris Angel's work.
No, I haven't.
Oh, you haven't? Okay, we've got to get him a tape, Uri, of some of the things that Chris Angel has done and some of the things you've done, of course, on this program once you two get into it. But again, a lot of it, Edgar, is what you've been looking into over all these years, and that is the ability of the mind to do these incredible things.
Yes, that's true.
How does the mind become so powerful even without the use of the brain?
Well, you're asking a good question, and those are questions right at the very heart of the science intrigue at this moment, is to understand these issues, and very frankly, we don't.
And it goes on for... And Uri, I am sure even you too, with the years of experience that you've had and the many times you and I have talked, the answer is difficult to find, isn't it?
Well, I have to go back to... Albert Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, that for one side we look at objects and we think they're solid, but they're really not. They equal energy. If you put a microscope into your hand, you'll discover cells, molecules, atoms, and energy. I think everything moves. Everything has a vibration, a frequency. We live in an ocean of motion. And I think that some people can manipulate that energy and make these amazing, wonderful things that are still scientifically unexplained. My last words, I would like to really contribute to Ed, because, you know, whenever I'm asked, who is the one person that influenced your life, I always say Ed Mitchell. He's such a great individual. He's such an intellect. He's such a wise soul I'm like I used the word before, I'm mesmerized by his intelligence and his personality and his friendship. He's such a great guy. And thank God that I met Ed, and he's been my mentor for all these years.
Well, I knew when we were going to have Edgar on this program, Uri, we had to have you on for at least a short segment, because you two are so important to this field. And I'm glad that we as humans have had this opportunity to have both of you on this walking this planet.
Well, thank you both, and thank you, Uri, for those nice words. And we've been friends for all these years, trying to figure out how the world works in ways that's very strange.
Well, I can tell you this, that without you, I wouldn't be where I am, and maybe I wouldn't be who I am. So thank you, and George, thanks for getting us both together.
Thank you, Uri. You take care of yourself. We'll talk to you right before that NBC show hits the air in October. We'll be back again with Edgar Mitchell in just a moment, as we'll talk about his new work now, The View from Space, and what a view it is. And we'll be back with Dr. Edgar Mitchell in just a moment. I want to tell you about the free CD you get, the interview that Al Bielek did with Art Bell a long time ago on the Philadelphia Experiment. That is yours as a gift, a classic show, when you subscribe or renew your After Dark newsletter. And when you do, a part of those proceeds will go to Mr. Al Bielek of the Philadelphia Experiment. So you can call 1-888-727-5505, or you can go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Edgar, let's talk a little bit about The View from Space. Tell me about that work.
Well, it actually is an old work that I recorded almost 30 years ago on audio tape, describing my experience of seeing Earth and the heavens and from space on the way back from the moon. And it got tucked away in a little audio cassette in my closet for many years, and my young son and his mother a few years ago, about 3 years ago, pulled it out and said this ought to be on modern media, and proceeded to make some CDs and DVDs from it, and they have been quite well received, although I haven't entered a major marketing effort on them. They've been quite well received by those folks that have had a chance to listen to them. That's kind of the story. And so they've made a set of CDs, part of with three CDs. Two of them are just a tour guide description of going to the moon. The third one is this View from Space, a message of peace that describes the epiphany, the insights that I had on coming back from the moon. And that's been quite well received. Thank you.
Edgar, as you look at worldwide events now, and everybody concerned about the event of possible nuclear holocaust, that nukes could get in the hands of the wrong people, do you hold, I guess, mankind in esteem to the point where you think we're going to get out of this, we're going to be okay, or do you think we're headed for disaster?
I think we have all the opportunity to learn that violence only begets more violence, and learn how to conduct our lives with each other and on this planet as a civilization, short of blowing ourselves up. It's very evident that we could do that with if we're not careful, and so far we haven't been very careful. But Minister Fuller, at the beginning of the space age, pointed out back in the 50s that we're the crew of Spaceship Earth, but we're a crew in mutiny, and how do you run a spaceship with a mutinous crew? And that's exactly what we are. We haven't learned to conquer and control our passions and our greed and our belief that our ego, that what we believe is the best thing and the only thing to believe. And so we're still a juvenile species. We're just barely out of the trees, frankly.
You know, though they say we have free will. Something went wrong with us when we were created. I mean, we're too violent.
Well, exactly. But the point is, we can overcome that. This is exactly what my View from Space is about, is to having an insight, tuning in and recognizing we're all connected, that it's all part of the same thing. We're all one, as it were. And getting that message across, learning to live it, is what's vital here. Now, we see different examples of how this transformational idea takes place. And we see it in folks who've had near-death experiences, we so-called out-of-body experiences, these types of experiences where they suddenly see their life and themselves and civilization and humanity and nature with totally new eyes, and that's what we're talking about. And when that happens, we have the chance to transform ourselves and to learn to live in harmony and peace. Which is the way we're designed to live. But we have to overcome our greed, our tendency towards self-service only, and to start to look at the greater good. Now, all the great religions at their core teach this, but when they get politicized and enculturated and perverted by these human frailties, they seem to be something else. And so, in my opinion, the radicals in each tradition, it doesn't matter which tradition, the radicals in each tradition get off track and take us in the wrong direction. And that's what is happening right now.
I sometimes wonder that to our benefit, if we could only get visited publicly by extraterrestrials who would clearly, like the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, they land right there on the lawn in Washington, D.C., and an alien like Michael Rennie comes out with his robot, and all of a sudden, I would guess this planet may finally wake up, but I don't understand why that doesn't happen, because we believe we've been visited, but why don't they do that?
Well, I would say, frankly, George, that the problem is our problem, not theirs. They're waiting to see if we're going to mature and come to our senses and start to realize and develop our own destiny, as opposed to having to be saved, when we really have all the capability right within ourselves to do the right thing, and we just aren't doing it.
And that's a good point. We do want to be saved. And maybe that's not our mission. We've got to do this ourselves.
That is exactly my point, is that we are put together in such a way that is what the, in my view, the view from space, the message of peace is all about, is it turns out that that was an experience of viewing the heavens and our Earth and ourselves from a distance and having the big picture perspective suddenly thrust upon you and realizing that we don't have to be this way, that violence is simply not the right approach, that violence only begets more violence. And when we pursue that in that way, we're just wrong. We are not reaching our potential or our maturity. And we will surely destroy ourselves if we keep doing that. And it's not up to somebody to save us. It's up to us to save ourselves.
Sure thing. From your entire trip during that period in 1971, from the Earth to the Moon, what for you, or maybe even back, what for you was the most inspiring, the most awe-inspiring?
Well, it was precisely what we were just talking about. It comes from seeing Earth from space and the heavens in that setting to see the big picture. And just to make the long story short, after I came back, this was such a powerful experience when I recognized that the molecules of my body and the molecules in the spacecraft had been prototyped in some ancient generation of stars, and that it's really all one, that we're interconnected in this way, and accompanied by a realization that was ecstatic, blissful. And coming back, and eventually with the help of some scholars, finding that was description of that was not in our science literature, but in the ancient Sanskrit, and it's called samadhi. Salvakalpa Samadhi, where you see things as separate as they really are, they're separate, but recognize underlying that is a connectedness. They're really all one. And learning to accept that, live that way, and get rid of our violent tendencies is what evolution and development is really all about.
Share with us, if you can, Edgar, because I'm getting chills just thinking of the question. And that is that very first moment that you were back on planet Earth and you looked up at a full moon. What did you feel?
Well, these types of experiences I'm just describing come back all the time. I have been able to recreate them. And it's a state of mind that you get into. And that's precisely why I founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences, to study consciousness, to study this phenomena, and to see what we humans can make out of it. What are we missing as we live our lives, as we evolve into hopefully something that will sustain ourselves on this planet instead of continuing to kill ourselves off with our stupidities?
I want to ask you this, and I want you to take this question with the incredible respect and friendship I have for you. But did you ever get, when you came back, so overcome with emotion that you broke down, that you cried because of this entire event?
Oh, well, I've done that many times when I get deep into that and study the condition of we humans and our short-sightedness. There's a lot of things that can get me emotional in that regard, absolutely.
It's got to be a feeling that I envy you.
Well, I'm a very fortunate person to have had that experience and have the privilege of trying to tell people that experience and hopefully help move us a little bit more toward a sustainable future rather than one in which we self-destruct out of our stupidities.
I sometimes wonder if we as a planet need to take that big hit, whether it's an asteroid or some kind of nuclear holocaust, which will finally make us wake up, because we're just not doing what you've said we should do right now.
Well, that is true. We are not examining ourselves and going inside and discovering what is really inside ourselves. We're taking it all for granted. And not asking the deep questions. And we're at a point in history where we have since World War II, and we have created the nuclear weaponry technologies and worked very hard to avoid using them, but we haven't worked hard enough to avoid using them. We still dangle them out there like the sword of Damocles. If anybody messes with us, we'll use it on them. And we have to, as an entire Earth civilization, get beyond that. And right now, we're not close to that.
No, we're not. We're quite a ways from that, I think.
And the radical, religious fanatics, and
yep,
these are extremists on all the world, are the ones that are causing it. And we have to get past that. That brand of religion has become part of the problem, not the solution to anything. And we have to have solutions, not more problems.
You must be proud of the Institute.
My folks, I'm no longer involved in day-to-day activity. I sit on the board, of course, and I'm still on the executive committee.
You're now the senior member of the Institute, huh?
Beg your pardon?
You're now the senior member of the Institute.
Well, yes. They are wonderful people. They're working very hard to help get this idea of transformation across and to do the science that, since science seems to be our truth table these days, when properly done, to use our science to demonstrate this and to understand exactly how these phenomena, and particularly the phenomenon that we were just talking about with Uri Geller a while ago, how does mind and consciousness enter into this? Because it's very clear that it does. We just don't have the tools or the understanding yet to be able to write the equations for this, as it were.
Edgar, are you a believer now in the multiverse, that there are more than one universe?
Well, it depends on what you want to, how you describe that. I think we have a lot to learn about cosmology. I'm not convinced, as are some of the others. Astronomers and astrophysicists and cosmologists are starting to challenge the Big Bang as the way things came into being. I don't think that is the right answer. I think we're on the track of new answers of how matter arose and arises out of the quantum zero-point energy field, and being able to codify that in a better way. So the future is there, and I think we're still on the track of it, but we're just not on a sustainable path, and it's catching up with us very quickly. You know, we're at peak oil, we're destroying our environment. All of these issues of sustainability are very vital right now, and we better pay attention to them.
You know, we've been doing some mind consciousness experiments, Edgar, on the program with some pretty remarkable success, to the point where I always was a believer, but I'm more convinced now than ever that collectively, when people set their minds for common good, they can change events. They can alter events.
Of course. We've done that over and over again. When we get enough people thinking in the same vein, we have a powerful collective effect. Absolutely.
We've moved hurricanes. We've pushed them down
Absolutely.
From category fives to ones. Meteorologists were, there was a couple of years ago we did one, that was heading, of course, toward Louisiana, not Katrina. And meteorologists said, we've never seen a hurricane drop in force so fast. And it was right around that period where we did our mind experiment to slow it down.
Yeah. Yes. We're quite familiar with these techniques.
How do you feel now about NASA? If I can move on to something else for just a second.
NASA has a mission. It has much that it needs to be doing, and it will do it slowly. We have to get the entrepreneurs of our world moving in that direction. But first of all, we got to start solving this problem of sustainability, and doing it with the proper respect for public service and the proper respect for the greater good. You know, the central message in all of this is service to the greater good is really the most satisfying and the only truly satisfying career. That when we're working to make it a better world, that's what's important. And as long as NASA is pursuing space travel and our under-space technologies for the purpose of making the world a better place to live and our technologies more useful to us, that's an appropriate approach. If we're doing it to continue our warlike behaviors and our approaches to life like that, then it's a wrong path.
Do you think we're going to lose any distance to the Chinese, for example, who want to put a man on the moon? They want to establish a base. The Russians are talking about it now. And that's another interesting story. I find it fascinating where they're talking about establishing a base on the moon in 15 years or so. And still, they haven't gone to the moon. And they were ahead of us for a moment in the space race.
Well, I think there's much to say for the way, for our ingenuity and the way we go about things. No doubt about that. But I think, yes, the Chinese are quite capable of now doing it. They have learned from us. They have their own approach to things. And they're people to be reckoned with. Let's just hope that they don't have to learn the message, help us learn the message the hard way of using warlike behaviors in order to accomplish a goal.
What's your greatest fear, Edgar?
My greatest fear is that we will ignore this problem, this opportunity that we have in front of us to resolve the sustainability issue and keep this civilization going, and that we will find ourselves engaging in a nuclear holocaust that may be the end of everything.
You say you're not concerned about the asteroid that's going to hit us. It's us,
well,
ourselves.
Well, that's a possibility. Fortunately, there's people like Rusty Schweikert, one of our colleagues from Apollo 9, who's very interested in that and working very hard on it. So we all have something to do with it in this larger scheme of things.
When people still hear the word astronaut, do they get excited about that?
Some people do. That is true. They certainly do.
And I know. We all wanted to be astronauts when we were kids. You did it.
Well, I was very fortunate and placed myself in the right channel at the right time.
Well, you had the right stuff, Edgar.
Thank you, sir. But, see, it all happened quickly. It all happened when I was coming back from the Korean War. Actually, I was aboard a carrier in 1957, completing my tour of duty, my second tour of duty in the Pacific, when Sputnik went up. And I realized that humans would be right behind robot spacecraft. And that sounded like something interesting to do. So that changed. I was coming back to be a test pilot. And
finish that story, Edgar, when we come back. I'd love to hear how you got named to be an astronaut. It's his final hour. We started him early. So hang around. Edgar Mitchell's with us. And your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.